This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this July 4th holiday weekend. Interesting, it doesn't necessarily feel like a holiday weekend. I guess when it's linked together, it's a little bit more since many people are on vacation all week. Some of us were working yesterday, so it's kind of a mishmash of a holiday, but nevertheless, many things going on around there, and among them, it's great to have you here listening to our program. And I have a great program for you today. My guest will be Dr. Eason Simon. Dr. Simon is a captain, now retired, 1 week retired from the United States Coast Guard, and a public health specialist. He has a vast amount of information to share. He is a flight surgeon with the United States Coast Guard, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about his experience with public health, his experience as a flight surgeon, and I think that you'll really enjoy that. I first came to know him when he was the chief medical officer at the Coast Guard Academy, and it was great to work with him. There, and he put into place so many things to help modernize the system a little bit better, and he'll talk about his position there. He's now retired and living in the Washington, D.C. area, and I just thought to reach out to him a little bit because we'll talk a little bit about public health today as well. Also, we're going to have some time. He's going to join us at 11:30. I'm also going to talk about a few things about one of the most frightening things, I think, neurologically that we have to deal with in a patient and in ourselves personally is amnesia. I don't think it's something we think about an awful lot. It's often seen in the movies, right? You hear about these older movies where someone had amnesia, doesn't remember who they are or where they are. Well, there is a condition called transient global amnesia that's not as uncommon as you would think. So I'm going to talk about that in the second segment of today's program to give everyone some insight into actually what is amnesia and what happens to these patients and why they become amnestic. So this day in medicine is always July 6th, 1885. This is an interesting one. Joseph Meister was the 9-year-old boy, and on July 6th, 1885, he received the first injection of microbes from Louis Pasteur for his hydrophobia vaccine. Now, for many of you, you'll know that hydrophobia is just another term for rabies. And it became known as hydrophobia because you developed so much tightness in your throat that it was painful to even think about drinking water. So it developed the term hydrophobia. Now, at that time, in the 1800s, it was more than 99% fatal. Now, rabies is actually a viral infection, and it affects the brain. It produces, it results in a thing called Negri bodies that we see in pathologic sections of the brain. So it affects the brain, and at that time, uniformly ended in a fatality. So what happened to this young man, Joseph? He was bitten by a dog that was believed to be rabid. Now, Pasteur at the time was working on and had successfully vaccinated dogs against rabies by using spinal tissue from rabid rabbits. So rabbits who had the rabies infection, he took spinal tissue and used it to inoculate dogs successfully. So he did the same thing with this young man, Joseph Meister, and inoculated him with these microbes that he took from the spinal tissue of rabbits. And lo and behold, he lived, and actually lived a very long life. And I love the part about, you know, following up on these stories and what happened to them. So when Joseph grew up, he actually became the caretaker for the Pasteur Institute. And he dedicated his life then to Dr. Pasteur and Pasteur's work, realizing that, you know, he would have died had it not been for this effort. And just thinking about it, I mean, this is, again, a vaccine that we have to use occasionally. I remember one incident in Norwich, actually, in the last several years. Two fellas were out playing golf and were attacked by a bobcat. And one of them was bitten pretty badly. They knew that the bobcat was probably rabid, and they actually did eventually capture the bobcat and prove that it was rabid. So that person had to undergo this series of rabies vaccine. So again, something from 1885 that we continue to use today effectively, and also in vaccinating our animals and keeping dogs safe from rabies. But it's still there. You have to be very careful of it. Often if you see an animal that typically is nocturnal and they're walking around aimlessly during the day, it's because they become blinded from rabies, so they don't know the difference between day and night. So if you were to see a raccoon in the middle of daytime wandering around, there's a good chance that that animal has rabies and needs to be reported. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back to talk a little bit about public health. And basically, there's a saying that public health saved your life today, and you probably didn't know it. So we're going to talk about public health in general, and then we're going to talk about transient global amnesia. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And if you have any questions that you'd like me to pose to Dr. Simon later on today about public health or military medicine, I'm happy to do so. You can reach me at info@alessimd.com. Now, the emails you send me, I really look at all of them. I enjoy them. The purpose of giving you the email and email access is if you have health questions, if you have ideas for shows, questions you may want to propose to our guests. It is not a forum for political beliefs, let's put it that way. So if you have some political agenda that you want to get across, I suggest you email Tom Shattuck or Todd Feinstein in the afternoon. These are much more politically oriented shows. But if you have a medical question or want to participate in the conversation here, please reach out to info@alessimd.com. The saying, there's an interesting saying that I came across this past week. Public health saved your life today, and you probably didn't know it. And it's interesting because I think we take public health for granted. We take for granted that we have vaccines, that we have seatbelts, that we have no smoking signs and limit secondhand smoke. So we have these things that are in place and clearly have saved lives. And there's a show coming out on PBS called The Invisible Shield, really talking about the history of public health. In listening to some podcasts, I learned quite a bit, so I thought I'd share some of it with you. You know, their work in public health has primarily been hidden to a large extent until the recent global pandemic. And is a difference. It's a difference with clinical medicine. We spend a lot of time treating the sick. But in public health, their goals are to keep everybody healthy. So it's an interesting different and a different approach to health. I think the biggest thing that I learned was how public health has had such an impact in increasing our life expectancy. When you think about it, historically, over the course of the past 150 years, and this is an interesting fact that I had no concept of and never thought of. So over the past 150 years, the life expectancy in wealthy countries, so these are industrialized nations, not unindustrialized nations or countries that don't have industry, right? So wealthy countries, our life expectancy has doubled. So understand that in wealthy countries, 150 years ago, people generally died in their mid-40s. And now, in many countries, you're not dying until you're 80. So they've doubled life expectancy. It was also assumed in many places that when children were born, there were a large percentage of those children that were going to die. And yet now the death of an infant is rare. So again, we really need to understand how much public health has impacted our lives, whether it be the smallpox vaccine or just safe water, safe housing, clean air, safe milk for infants. These are all efforts in public health to keep us all healthy and living longer. But one of the problems is we've come up more recently against a lot of obstacles, basically disinformation, misunderstandings, the latest skepticism about science, and distrust of government. And although that's always been there, the internet has now given them a platform to work against these public health efforts. The latest one I happened to see yesterday was the fact that sunscreen will cause cancer. Oh, my goodness. And that you shouldn't use sunscreen. That's just a harmful thought, right? And it's a thought that can result in people living through many painful surgeries and potential death. So again, how does this come out? Well, somebody gets an idea, or let's face it, we have enemies in the world, right? So there are enemies planting this information out there so that people will say, "Yeah, let me take my chances." So again, we need to be very mindful of looking at the science. There are studies, good studies done that we talk about on this program, and that has really been the goal of this program, is to get good information out there and let people draw their own conclusions. And the goal is to keep people as healthy as we can as long as possible. Now, another thing that comes up, again, under the field of public health, is gun violence is now a public health crisis. Now, before everybody starts screaming Second Amendment, I understand the Second Amendment. People have a right to bear arms, but they need to be able to use those arms safely and store them safely. Children are dying. People are dying because people show up getting access to guns too easily, even with mental health problems, and they are out there. Every weekend we hear about it, right? Someone decides that they're going to go into a park or somewhere and start blasting people. So again, we need to be mindful. The number one cause of death of children is guns. So again, it's a public health issue. Now, as much as people are digging in about this, they dug in about the Surgeon General putting a message on cigarette packs. So I think that we need to start accepting public health and supporting public health. as best we can. Okay, I wanted to get to this topic, and I have a few minutes left here. I got about 4 minutes here. Transient global amnesia. Just think about it. This idea of the sudden onset of profound confusion and memory impairment. That's basically what you start seeing in someone. It typically happens in older people. It can happen in men and women. It generally comes on after some level of exertion. And typically, it's a healthy individual. It's not somebody who's impaired with cardiac disease. They've had strokes, a high blood pressure. Healthy individuals will suddenly develop this profound confusion. It typically lasts less than 24 hours and more likely between 1 and 8 hours. And people just feel confused, but they function. So they're going about their day somewhat confused and in a fog, but they're able to do everything. They're able to cook, in cases, able to drive. But then what you notice is that if someone is asking them something, they keep repeating. If they're asking someone a question, despite getting an answer, they keep repeating the same question. So typically a loved one, a family member, a spouse will notice this. And that's how it usually becomes noticed and brought to the emergency room. These folks return to their full normal mental status, but they recall absolutely no details for that period of time of 1 to 8 hours or for a whole 24 hours. And that's the most frightening thing because they keep asking themselves, what happened in that period of time? What happened? And it's very upsetting for these folks because they recall absolutely no details for that period of time. And they've looked for a lot of potential etiologies, but no one has been able to prove the cause of it. So EEGs, brainwave tests, during the episode are normal. The thing that we have found is on MRI, there's a lesion, a punctate area, like a little hole of diffusion in the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is where we associate with organizing our memories. So usually that is found about 24 hours after the event. And the recurrence of it is rare. Other things that could be confused with it are seizures, which is a transient form of epilepsy. Sometimes you can have some amnesia with migraine headaches, a form of migraine headaches. And obviously it's something we see in people who have head trauma, where they have difficulty remembering events that have led up to their head trauma and for a period of time after. But transient global amnesia itself is an independent entity and something we see in clinical neurology. And I thought it was just interesting to chat a little bit about that. So we're going to take a break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Eason Simon, Captain Eason Simon, now retired. He was the chief medical officer at the United States Coast Guard Academy. And we're going to be talking about public health from his standpoint, a little bit about his career, and we're going to talk about flight surgeons. And I already have a question from John that I'm going to pose to Dr. Simon. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Welcome back to Healthy Rounds. My guest today is Dr. Eason Simon. Dr. Simon is a captain in the United States Coast Guard Academy, or was as of last week. He is now retired and joined the field of civilian life. Captain Simon, while he was at the Coast Guard Academy, was the chief medical officer, and that's when we met. And it gave me great pleasure to work with him and learn a lot from him about military medicine and how things are handled at an institution like the Coast Guard Academy. Eason, welcome to the show.
Dr. Alessi, thank you so much. What an absolute privilege and honor to be here. Thank you for the invite. And I remember that very first day that we did meet back at New London, Connecticut Academy, and it's been a pleasure just having a chance to know you and having a chance to work with you. And thank you for volunteering and providing your services to the Coast Guard and the Coast Guard Academy. Great to be here.
Well, it's been an honor for me. But let's talk about you a little bit, because I think your career has taken an interesting turn from the standpoint of college. You went to Harvard, undergraduate, then went to Emory. Take us through this. What made you decide to join the military and become a military physician?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for the question. You know, I definitely have to start even before college with some of the folks that set me up so well to be in the military and for the academic rigors of medicine as well. You know, whether it's my parents encouraging me to, you know, pursue the medical route, or my coach, Coach Finan, who said, "Hey, Ihsan, you should apply to Harvard." And I did, because of Coach Finan at my school. And then the military aspect, you know, I was actually born in Guyana, South America. My dad's Guyanese, mom's Jamaican. I came to the country when I was 5, so I did not have my citizenship until my first year of medical school. And in the military, you can enlist. You don't have to be a citizen to enlist, but to be an officer, you have to have your citizenship. So once I got my citizenship first year of medical school, then I learned about flight surgery in particular, and I learned about military medicine, and I said, "Man, that sounds fun." You know, I said, I want to do that, and I want to, you know, serve my country and see the world. And that literally was my thought process: serve the country, see the world, and do something fun and exciting, like being a flight surgeon. And that's kind of how the military aspect of the career got going. And then being an athlete, I played football at Harvard. I ran track at Harvard. High school, I also wrestled. So I was kind of, you know, always into the athletic arena in different ways. And that also lined up with the military as well. So those were kind of the beginnings. And then once I joined and found out about the great people, the great service, the great mission that our uniformed services has, it just aligned well with who I am and the things that I enjoy doing. So thanks for the question.
Ihsan, I actually want to take a step back. And it was interesting. I listened to one of the interviews you did in another podcast. And you talked a little bit about your high school career in St. Louis, at the St. Louis Priory. And I think you and I kind of had a similar experience in high school. Can you talk a little bit about your experience at the St. Louis Priory?
Sure. Yeah. I tell you what, Priory was so foundational to me, not just academically foundational, but also as a person, as a citizen of this country, and, you know, the value formation. So many things, hard work, discipline, a lot of things were formed at Priory. And Priory is a small boys' school, Catholic school, as you mentioned. We only graduated 40 guys in my class. So, you know, we all knew each other. It's pretty small. We started in seventh grade, and it went to 12th. And back then, we only had about 310 total in the whole school between seventh and 12th. We were a significant portion of the faculty were monks. They would pray for us. We would have, you know, service, and they provided not just an excellent educational base, but also a strong moral base and moral foundation as well. And then with the size of the school and how it was structured, we were required to participate in athletics, and there were a lot of additional requirements for a school that size and for the sort of academic discipline that they wanted to instill. So that really was a great foundation for me personally. And actually, I'll come full circle. My retirement ceremony was now up 4 weeks ago, June the 3rd. And actually, one of the first people I called to speak at my ceremony was my high school track coach, Coach Suarez. And sure enough, he came, flew up from St. Louis. And just last month, he spoke at my military retirement ceremony at Coast Guard headquarters. So just coming full circle almost 35 years later and showing you just how significant that 6 years of my life was for me at Priory. And cool to hear that we had some common background there, Dr. Alessi.
Well, it was interesting, although mine was a lot earlier than yours. But, you know, I attended a smaller Catholic boys' school in the Bronx, New York, Mount St. Michael Academy. And I also found that it provided such a foundation for me. It was the Marist brothers who ran the school and still run the school. The school is still in existence, and I still keep in touch with my various classmates. We get together, try to get together once a year. We just celebrated our 50th in 2022. So I really identified with that part of your education. But I want to move on because we already have a question from John. And are flight surgeons in the military always surgeons? And if not, why are they called surgeons? I think that so many people don't understand what is a flight surgeon.
Sure. And I could say I was definitely one of those people before I joined the military and before I went to Pensacola to become a flight surgeon for the 6 months of training in the Navy. But yeah, the summary of a flight surgeon, what a flight surgeon is, we are primary care providers for military pilots, military air crew. And that's really the totality of it. Now, there's some, you know, additional considerations with that and what that means in terms of what we do and how we train and the history of flight surgeons. But we are not people who perform surgery in the air. That's not what it means. But the term flight surgeon back in World War One, they used to call sort of all the physician surgeons. And then when the military aviation came on board later in the early 19th century, that vestige of the term surgeon that was applied to physicians in general rolled over to this newer category of aviation-specific physicians, and they called them flight surgeons. So they did not perform surgeries in the air then, nor do we now, but that's just the history of the term, and we're primary care providers. And in my case, I originally was a Navy flight surgeon, and in the case of the Navy, it's a six-month school down in Pensacola, Florida, where all naval pilots, the naval air crew train initially, Naval and Marine Corps, actually, as well as Coast Guard and some you might have other services rotating through as well. But that's sort of the birthplace of naval aviation, Pensacola, Florida. 6 months of school, and then you become and in that training, there's some of the same curriculum that the pilots are going through. Now, we're not pilots, just to make that clear, but we do some of the training that the pilots do. And, of course, it's only 6 months as opposed to, you know, to be a full-up Navy pilot might take you 3 years, depending on what platform you're going to. But we do some flying with instructors, and we fly with air crew. And then once you're designated flight surgeon, you go on to provide the aviation medical care to military pilots, military air crew, and you also get to fly. So we have wings, we're air crew, and that, of course, is a huge benefit of being a flight surgeon and one of the things that we enjoy doing. We deploy with our air wings, with our aviation squadrons, with our aviation assets, and we provide care, whether it's in the Navy, on an aircraft carrier, a large deck amphib, or wherever it might be. In the case of the Coast Guard, it might be at an air station, overseas, on a boat, all sorts of different areas that we provide aviation medical care. And you can also think of it as we're an occupational medicine specialist for aviation medicine. So hopefully that answers that question there, Dr. Alessi.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. I guess how many flight surgeons are there, would you say, in the country? Is it something it sounds like it's a smaller group than you would think.
It's a pretty small group. So, for example, in the case of the Coast Guard, I don't quote me on this, but roughly around 40 aviation medicine billets or so, positions. A billet is a position in the military. So maybe something approximately 40 for the Coast Guard. Now, the Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force, Army obviously also flies. Much larger, you know, organization. So the Coast Guard only has about 40,000 total members. The Marine Corps, maybe around 180,000, Navy, maybe around 300,000, et cetera, Army, you know, much larger. And of that entire population, there's only a subset of aviation. And in that subset of aviation, there's a subset of flight surgeons. So can't give you the specific numbers for how many are in the other services, Navy and and Army and Air Force, et cetera. But it's a small number, and we kind of, you know, a lot of us know each other, and certainly in the Coast Guard, which is one of the smallest cadres of flight surgeons, we really kind of all know each other because we're so small.
I think when we think of the Coast Guard, a lot of people don't think of aviation, right? They're mostly,
correct.
I mean, we always see helicopters, right, rescuing mm-hmm. people, but I don't think, how many, are there a lot of fixed-wing aircraft?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked about the Coast Guard. So, you know, a lot of people may have never even heard of the Coast Guard on your show. Obviously, there are some who are familiar with it. But for those who, hey, what's the Coast Guard? You know, most people know about the Army, the Navy, Air Force, et cetera. But Coast Guard, as I just mentioned, about 40,000 active duty. Now, there's additional people who work in the Coast Guard. For example, the Coast Guard Auxiliary, which almost doubles the force. There's 20 to maybe 25,000 or so auxiliarists, and those are volunteer members who serve. But the Coast Guard has been around since August 4, 1790, and has about 11 statutory missions, and aviation is a huge component of some of the operations of the Coast Guard, particularly in the context of this conversation. We're talking about flight surgery, so you might see aviation and with the Coast Guard and search and rescue. That's a big one that the audience might be aware of, search and rescue with the Coast Guard. You know, folks might have seen the Coast Guard involved in Hurricane Katrina. Folks might have seen the Coast Guard involved with Deepwater Horizon, oil spills, the unfortunate situation that happened in Baltimore just recently with the bridge, and a huge Coast Guard response to help coordinate the cleanup, you know, of that situation. So there's all sorts of different things that the Coast Guard is involved in, fixing aids to navigation, enforcing fisheries, et cetera, et cetera. And aviation is one of the components of the Coast Guard and a great mission. And with your question about fixed wing versus rotary wing, Coast Guard has multiple platforms on both fixed wing, as i.e. airplanes, as well as helicopters. So there's multiple types of helicopters, multiple types of fixed wing assets. And by the way, Coast Guard has some great locations, Hawaii, Miami, San Diego, you know, all these fantastic spots where you can be stationed as a flight surgeon, as a pilot, as air crew. And certainly it's it was fun for me to be involved in the Coast Guard for about 20 years, over 20 years.
Isn't there also an Arctic location?
So one of the missions of the Coast Guard, in terms of the polar, we call them polar rollers, or, you know, there's scientific exploration, there's assessments of ice caps. So there's actually a specific Coast Guard aviation unit that deals with assessing the ice caps in the Arctic region. And, you know, there might be medical providers that are deployed aboard the polar icebreakers because they're gone for a while. There might be Coast Guard assets involved with the scientific explorations in the Arctic and all that. So, and the Arctic, that's a expanding area of interest for the Coast Guard, for the nation. And yes, big, significant operational component of the Coast Guard is in that Arctic region.
I'm just wondering if that's a popular choice among assignments as opposed to Hawaii, mm-hmm. but we won't go there.
Some people love Alaska.
Yeah. What's the most common problem you come up, medical problem you encounter in flight crews and pilots? What would you
sure.
say is the most common thing that comes up?
Well, you know, all these things might sound exciting and fun and flying, but when it comes down to some of the common things being common, really, you know, simple things like upper respiratory infections and, you know, just your
sure.
bread and butter primary care medicine. Because at the core of it, a flight surgeon is providing that primary care for the aviation component of the service. So, you know, we see the same things that a family medicine provider out in town who's not a flight surgeon would see. So whether it's something as simple as a cold, the common cold. Now, there's some aspects of aviation that are important to consider. So, for example, if you have a cold, while you might be able to do your desk job without a problem, you know, going at altitude or if you're in the Navy or Air Force and pulling G's, you know, while you have a cold and congestion, you know, you could rupture an eardrum, you could, you know, have some significant disequilibrium issues and, you know, cause a mishap. And so that, even though that's a very common thing, one of the most common things you see, how it impacts the workforce and your work environment, that's that occupational medicine component of a flight surgeon where you have to appropriately adjudicate whatever medical situation you see in terms of can this person still safely fly? And that's a big bread and butter of the flight surgeon to determine, hey, can this person safely perform their job in a military aircraft? So, yeah, and then, of course, you see other things, you know, high blood pressure, you know, high cholesterol, just like everybody else. So, but, yeah, even though there might be common, it's how does this impact the person's ability to do their job in the air? Because the air is different than being on ground.
We're chatting today with my guest, Dr. Eason Simon, Captain, United States Coast Guard, retired. Eason, I have a question now, and I guess a lot of people may not know, I didn't know it originally, is when you transitioned from Navy to Coast Guard, you actually became part of the Public Health Service.
Right.
Can you explain what the Public Health Service is? I think we always see the Surgeon General wearing, you know, a uniform, a black uniform of types. So how did that work out that you became part of Public Health Service and then part of Coast Guard?
Yeah, great question. So glad you brought that up. Because I think you're right. Just, you know, being in the Public Health Service since 2004, I've certainly come across a lot of people who have never heard of it. And quite frankly, I didn't hear of it until the Navy was downsizing positions in 2004. And I was looking for a job and I came across the PHS. So just briefly, the PHS, the Public Health Service, the Commissioned Corps, dates back to 1798. And the Commissioned Corps itself was established in 1889. So the PHS has been around for a while. And the core mission of the PHS is very simple: protect, promote, and advance the health and safety of this country. And to do that, there's about 11 different categories of individuals, of disciplines, and even in some of those categories there are multiple disciplines, of medical professionals who execute that mission. So, for example, if you wanted to be a nurse or an environmental health specialist or an engineer or a dietitian, a physician, an audiologist, a health service, a healthcare administrator, all these different components and many, many more, don't have time to list all of them, can be part of the Commissioned Corps of the Uniforms of the United States Public Health Service, which is a uniform service. And there's about just a little over 6,000 of these healthcare active duty healthcare professionals in the PHS. And the sort of core driving principles are leadership, integrity, service, and excellence. And that's manifested in a lot of different ways. You can work for some 25 or 30 or plus different departments and agencies in the government, the Coast Guard, Bureau of Prisons, Indian Health Service, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Centers for Disease Control, National Institutes of Health, and many, many more. Again, we don't have time to list all of them. But that's a brief overview of the PHS. And for those who are interested and never heard of this, there's a fantastic documentary that just came out last year. It's called Invisible Corps in Officio Salutis, which is in service of health. That's about an hour documentary giving a history of the PHS, going a little bit deeper into what the PHS does, how it operates, whether it's talking about Ebola response, which is just a monumental response from the PHS, the only service that providing direct patient care. Just one of the many, many examples of a long history of the PHS protecting, promoting, and advancing the health and safety of the country. So thanks for that question.
You were on the front lines of us dealing with COVID at the Coast Guard Academy. I mean, you were in charge of keeping all the cadets safe. I'm going to ask you this, and we have a few minutes left. In the few minutes we have, what do you think are the things we did right during our response to the COVID pandemic? And what are the things we could have done better?
Sure. Are you specifically referring to the Coast Guard Academy or as a nation? Or
maybe as a nation, because you were a part of it in general. I mean, you were at the Coast Guard Academy. Granted, you had a different population. But in general, looking at it, what do you think?
Yeah, so obviously a huge, huge tectonic shift of life and existence and work that we all had to go through with the pandemic. So as a country, you know, I know there were so many different, you know, sort of opinions and ways to go about things and the differences of approach. But if you look at what we did as a country to flex and to adapt to this new thing, and I'm talking about a very global sort of look at the whole pandemic. This was a different thing. This was a new thing. This was a big thing. And as an entire country and world, we had to learn about it. We had to adapt. We had to acquire our strategy to attack it. And all those things took time. And I know there was challenges along the way. But for me, one of the big things that I, just as a country, as a world, is our adaptation and the ability to flex to this huge life change for every single person was impacted by this. Your job, your school, your, you know, your neighborhood, you know, all these different things. But we were able to adapt to that. And here, a few years later, we've got vaccines against the COVID. We had protocols in place that mitigated the effects of it. Yes, there was challenges along the way, but the capacity and the ability to just adapt, come up with strategies, implement those strategies, and improve health outcomes, to me, I thought was huge. And you know, from a microscopic view at the Coast Guard Academy, you know, when I was the medical director out there, again, this was new to me, it was new to our staff and all that, but we had to, just like from a global perspective, adapt. We had to adapt, and we had to maintain operations at the Coast Guard Academy in a very dynamic environment. Cadets were no longer on campus. How do we manage that? And we all had to come together as a community to figure all these things out. And all these just awesome people with great brain power, great ideas came together, and we figured it out. And we were able to navigate through the pandemic. It wasn't easy, but we're able to figure it out. So sorry to get a little long winded on that one, but,
no, but
the adaptation and the people resource to do it was huge.
That's great. Listen, I want to thank you. Thank you for your time. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, thank you for your service. You know, your 26 years serving all of us in the United States. Eason, I wish you the best of luck and best of health in your retirement, and I hope you keep in touch.
Well, thank you, Dr. Alessi. Absolute pleasure. And again, thank you that you took time out of your schedule to go through that Coast Guard Auxiliary pathway. And thanks to all those Coast Guard Auxiliarists, because I worked with a lot of them at the Coast Guard Academy in particular, and we could not do our job without them. And thanks for what you do here on this Healthy Rounds. It's you've been reaching a lot of people, and appreciate you, and continue doing the good work you're doing.
Thank you, and thank you again. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. If you missed any part of today's program, you could download the Healthy Rounds podcast at odyssey.com. Next up on WTIC, you're going to be listening to the Yankees versus the Red Sox for an afternoon of baseball. Until next week, please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rashford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.